Welcome to the Inside Elections podcast, where we analyze elections in a nonpartisan, data-driven, and accessible way. In this episode, we'll talk through the upcoming Democratic primary for Senate in Maryland and the general election that will greet the eventual winner. And we'll also dive into one of the big House primaries taking place in the Old Line State. And we'll do it all with the help of special guest Pamela Wood, politics reporter from the Baltimore Banner. Buckle up. I'm Jacob Rubashkin, deputy editor of Inside Elections, the go-to place for nonpartisan political analysis for more than 40 years. Now, I have not had a particularly interesting travel schedule over the last week or so, but I believe that Nathan's busy itinerary more than makes up for that. So, Nathan, tell us what you're about this week.
Yeah, well, and I'm Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections. I'm currently in San Antonio, Texas, specifically Texas 35th District, getting ready to speak to the Farm Credit Bank of Texas. Yesterday, I was in Raleigh in North Carolina's 2nd District speaking to a group. Tomorrow, I will be in Dallas, Texas, in Texas 6th District speaking to another group. So I am all over the place, and that's why people don't get to those folks watching on YouTube don't get to see my typical background because I'm in a lovely San Antonio ballroom or San Antonio hotel room. I will be in a ballroom in about an hour, but in a hotel room right now.
Oh, I think the interior decorator with those tastefully positioned frames is doing us some favors there behind you.
Yeah, when I set this up, the horse picture, I was right in front of the horse picture, and I had these ears, like the ears of that picture. I'm like, I better move this to the side a little bit. So hopefully we got the shot a little bit better.
Yeah, it looks great. So a little later on, we're going to talk through Maryland, all things Maryland with Pamela. But before we do that, let's go over a few brief headlines, the latest in congressional news. Nathan, what happened over the last couple weeks that our listeners should not miss?
Well, on Tuesday, Shamari Figures won the Democratic primary runoff in Alabama's 2nd District and is likely to be a member of Congress next year. He's a young black attorney in his late 30s. He was deputy chief of staff to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland. He also worked on the Hill for Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. Now, this is the redrawn district with a substantial black population that includes Montgomery, parts of Mobile, and rural counties along the Black Belt. Biden won it with about 56% in 2020, so it's not an extremely Democratic district, but attorney Caroline Dobson won the Republican runoff and was considered the weaker of the two Republican candidates in that race. And so Figure starts this election, this general election, as the considerable favorite to effectively take over what was a Republican seat because of this redraw.
Yeah. So Dobson defeated former state senator Dick Brubaker in the Republican primary runoff. Brubaker was a kind of well-regarded state lawmaker who had, you know, roots in I believe the Montgomery area, and placed first in the initial primary, but was not able to defeat Dobson in the runoff. And I know that he was the Republican that Democrats were a little bit more concerned about. But Figures, I think, was always going to be the favorite here. He placed first in the primary, in the initial primary. He's also the only one from the district. I think his opponent, Anthony Daniels, is actually from Huntsville. So all the way in the northern part of the state. The other thing I'll note here is that, you know me, I'm big on my Nepo babies of Congress, that story that I wrote a couple years back. And when I do the update, Shamari Figures will be a part of it. He is the son of two very high-profile state lawmakers, His father, who's now deceased, was the president pro temp of the Alabama State Senate back, I believe, in the 80s. His mother is still a state senator, I believe, both very prominent figures in the Black political community in Alabama. And figures leaned into it. He ran lots of ads talking about the lineage of service in his family and the work that his parents did in advocating for civil rights. So he'll be in the update for sure there.
And I have to say, the last thing about this race before is that figures in the runoff defeated a candidate named Anthony Daniels. And Anthony Daniels happens to be the same name as the actor who played C-3PO in Star Wars. I made that reference in a speech to a group, and it was crickets, Jacob. Nobody, there was nothing, no response whatsoever. And so I guess I learned when you're talking to groups, you learn what jokes work and what works and what doesn't. And that did not work at all. What did you find?
So House and Senate candidates had to file their quarterly financial reports this past week, telling us how much they raised and spent in the first 3 months of the year. Democrats have generally been outperforming Republicans on the hard dollar side, the dollars that candidates are raising themselves. Our friends at National Journal crunched the numbers and found that Democrats' most vulnerable members raised on average $832,000 over the first 3 months of the year, compared to $737,000 for the most vulnerable Republican incumbents. And of the 16 House challengers outraised the incumbents that they were running against, 14 of those were Democrats. Just two were Republicans. I've got a story coming out in the next issue of the newsletter about Arizona's 6th district. That was one of those races where the Democratic challenger, former state senator Kirsten Engel, actually almost doubled up Republican incumbent Juan Ciscomani. She raised almost $1.2 million over the first 3 months of the year. He raised just a little bit over $600,000. So the small dollar donations for the Democrats seem to be picking up, and you know, we'll see how big an advantage that gives them. But it's certainly something for Democrats in the House to be hopeful about moving forward.
And as a reminder to maybe the more normal people that are listening to the podcast, candidate fundraising matters in at least one regard, that candidates pay less for their television ads than the parties or the super PACs. And so when you get into a competitive race, and let's say the Republican candidate is underfunded compared to the Democratic candidate, and the parties come in to try to compensate, the parties or the super PACs are spending two or three times the amount of money for the same number of actual television ads that are on TV. So it can be done. The parties can make up that difference. It's just much less efficient and cost effective to do it on the party side. So that's why both Republicans and Democrats want their candidates to raise as much money as possible, because it's a better use of TV dollars.
Yeah. It can often be as much as three times, four times as expensive for outside groups to come in. And especially, again, not to harp on that Arizona race, but you know, the Arizona media markets are going to be very expensive this cycle, between a highly competitive presidential race and a highly competitive Senate race. And so while, you know, Ciscomani is not in such bad position that he has less money overall than Engel does, there are, it's never good to be outraced 2-1. There are a few Republican incumbents who now trail their Democratic challengers in cash on hand. Democrats have been doing well on the money side so far. I want to welcome our special guest, Pamela Wood of the Baltimore Banner. Pamela has covered Maryland politics for years at the Baltimore Sun, at the Capital Gazette, and now at the Banner, which is a really cool newsroom that opened up a couple years ago in Baltimore. Recommend you check it out. We are so glad to have her on the show today. Pamela, thank you for being here. We're going to talk all sorts of races in Maryland, but before we get to all that, you got to answer the question that all of our guests get posed when they come on the show, which is, what congressional district did you grow up in?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This is exciting. So I am a Marylander since age 10, and I grew up in what is now the 3rd Congressional District. I grew up in Howard County, Maryland. So for folks from DC area, you probably know where that is. And actually, I still live in the district today over in Anne Arundel County, but Maryland has been quite gerrymandered in the past. It bumped around to a bunch of different districts. It was the 7th for a while. But yeah, grew up in the 3rd and currently live in the 3rd.
Yeah, and I think that the 3rd district especially was kind of ground zero for the gerrymandering from 2010 to 2020.
It really was. There was a judge called it like a broken-winged pterodactyl laying prostrate across the state.
Very specific. Very specific.
Yes. And that is actually an accurate description. The 3rd was terrible, and then the 2nd kind of wrapped around it. I lived there for a while as well as an adult.
So that that part of Maryland has grown a little bit since you were a kid, but what was life like growing up in the 3rd district back then?
Well, I grew up in Columbia, in Howard County, the Choose Civility County, the Jim Rouse developer idealized version of a, you know, multicultural, like multi-income community, which is, you know, not quite its ideals, but it's, as a kid, it was quite boring, actually. As an adult, I appreciate, you know, what Columbia is like. There's a lot of greenery. There's a lot of tot lots and walking paths. It's very kind of idyll, you know, suburbia.
Well, and for those people who are tuning in, maybe for the first time, not only have Pamela, but we're very Maryland heavy because Jacob is from Montgomery County. So, but that's good. That's good for this episode.
Yeah, always enjoy talking about Maryland here on the show. So yeah, let's get right into it. We've got this big Senate race coming up in Maryland, big Democratic primary, big general election. We're going to talk about both. We're going to start with the primary. Let's take a brief listen to a couple of campaign ads that were recently on the airwaves from Congressman David Trone and Prince George's County Executive Angela also Brooks in this Democratic primary.
I served time in prison. There's a lot of resources that I can't access. Congressman Trone put his reputation on the line to back someone he never even met.
The hardest part of being a prosecutor is standing next to that mother that's just lost her child.
Few took that responsibility more seriously than Angela Alsobrooks.
Angela fought to convict the man that killed my son.
So clearly a contrast in messages from Congressman Trone, the billionaire owner of Total Wine, and Angela Alsobrooks, the county executive in Prince George's County, a former prosecutor, as you heard in that ad. We're under a month until Election Day here in Maryland, or there in Maryland, I should say. Pamela, what are you watching in the closing weeks of this contest between Trone and Alsobrooks?
Yeah, what's interesting about Trone and also Brooks is despite kind of those divergent ads, really you're not getting a lot of difference policy-wise between the two of them. Either one of them would be a reliable Democratic vote for, you know, making legal abortion and reproductive rights across the country, for example. But what's interesting here is that David Trone is massively, and I mean massively, self-funding his campaign. He is up to almost $42 million of his own money. Angela Alsobrooks, no slouch of fundraising, but she's at $7 million total over the course of the campaign, almost a year now. The question is, can Angela Alsobrooks get her message out and talk about her leadership and her style compared to David Trone? I mean, David Trone is just blanketing TV, radio, direct mail, and you know, we're about 4 weeks from traditional election day. People are already voting by mail. So can Alsobrooks get her message out and get people to know who she is? Or is it just, you know, Trone by default because more people know his name?
Yeah. And we've gotten a whole bunch of polls in kind of the last couple weeks of this race. I feel like it had been pretty quiet aside from some polls the Trone campaign had released themselves. But it seems like they're almost painting a little bit of a contradictory picture. Some of them have the race tightening. Some of them, I think you wrote about a poll the other day from one of the local Fox affiliates, I believe, that showed actually quite a significant gap between the two candidates. I guess, do we know where the race stands today and how much ground Alsobrooks has to make up?
Yeah, it's kind of polapalooza, which is unusual for Maryland, right? We don't normally get this much attention. You know, our races aren't always as competitive. So yeah, Fox 45 in Baltimore with the Baltimore Sun and University of Baltimore had a poll out this week. They had Trone up by 19 over Alsobrooks. A couple weeks ago, the Baltimore Banner and Goucher College had a poll that had Trone up by 9. And a couple weeks before that, the Washington Post and University of Maryland had a poll that showed him up by 7. So is he extending his lead? But in the middle of that, Angela Alsobrooks put out an internal that showed up 43-40. So within the margin, you know, very tight, but that's an internal poll. So you kind of take that with a grain of salt. It's really hard to know. There's still a significant number of undecided. I think the Sun and Fox 45 poll had about 12%, but the earlier polls had more like 20% undecided. So that may be where it comes down to. It's hard to gauge. It does look like from the polling Trone is ahead, but you know, who knows what happens in the final few weeks.
Pamela, can you talk about the role that, I guess, identity politics is playing in this primary? Because nationally, we've seen Democratic primary voters really wanting to elevate women, elevate candidates of color. In this case, Alsobrooks is both. And yet you have David Trone, an aging white guy, you know, leading this race. You also have the state's other senator, Chris Van Hollen, who is a white guy. But it doesn't so far appear that being a woman of color is really pushing her Alsobrooks across the line. Do you see that? Do you see that dynamic playing out at all, either past or in the next few weeks?
I think what's interesting here, it goes to what Marylanders want and pay attention to. I mean, yes, Angela Alsobrooks is a Black woman, and there have been so few Black women in the United States Senate. You know, as you said, underrepresentation of Black people, underrepresentation of women, she would embody that. But I think you've got a smart voter in Maryland who doesn't want to vote just based on somebody's race or gender. They want to see, what are they going to do for me? And the challenge, again, Alsobrooks has had is like getting her message out, talking about what she has done as a county executive, what she did as a prosecutor. But I think there is some, you know, maybe some hand wringing about, are we going to send, you know, for Democrats, are they going to send another white man, you know, to the Senate? But they also are looking at the general election, which candidate is going to go up best against Republican Larry Hogan, the former two-term governor, very popular. And that's an argument that each Alsobrooks and Trone are making, is electability. Like, I'm the one to beat Larry Hogan. So I think there's multiple factors there. Identity and representation is one, but it's one of multiple factors, I think.
And how the battle for Baltimore, I guess, how is the battle for Baltimore going? You were there, I guess you're in Annapolis right now at the State House, but being, you know, being in Baltimore, because there isn't a Baltimore candidate in the race, how is that playing out in the primary?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how this turns out. So Trone's base is Montgomery County. That's where he lives. His district goes from Montgomery County up to Frederick and out to Western Maryland. So thinking is that he will do well in Montgomery. Angela Alsobrooks, she's a county executive of Prince George's. And those are the two largest counties. So could perhaps they cancel each other out? And then you look at what's the next population center, which is the Baltimore region. Baltimore City is smaller than the surrounding Baltimore County, but it is like so heavily Democratic. The county around it is a little more purple. So they are both playing, you know, strong in Baltimore. I cannot go very, very long ride driving in the car around Baltimore and not hear a David Trone ad. And interestingly enough, one of the radio ads he's running right now in the Baltimore market has Prince George's County leaders endorsing him, and has, you know, the voices of Prince George's County politicians, which is interesting to do in Baltimore. I'm not quite sure the strategy there, but they're, you know, both been around Baltimore. They're debating Friday night on a TV station in Baltimore as well.
And race, I feel like, had been kind of an undercurrent in this contest for a long time, obviously, with the contrast and the backgrounds of the two candidates. But it really did kind of come to the fore in the last month or so when Trone accidentally used antiquated racial slur, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Antiquated is a word for it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it sounded like something from a Tarantino movie. But in this congressional hearing, the thing, though, that is kind of on my mind is like that was 4 days before the Key Bridge collapse. And so I guess I wonder how much did that really affect the race, if at all? Some, that seems like the kind of thing that could derail a campaign. But when you've got such a big event happening so soon after that captures all the media attention, has that made a difference? And has the Alsobrooks campaign done anything to try and capitalize on the fact that he, you know, use that word was, you know, in his vocabulary to use in that hearing when consolidating Black voters is so important and chipping away at white liberals is so important to the Alsobrooks coalition?
Right. Yeah, I think people are uncomfortable with that word, you know, probably no matter what your race is. You know, I think probably across the Democratic spectrum, voters would be concerned about that. And the Alsobrooks campaign really just kind of sat back. They didn't say any public statements. They didn't do any, you know, social media posts or put it into an ad. They kind of like just let it sit there and breathe. And, you know, sort of Trone caused his own problem and sort of watch it play out. But as you noted, a few days later, the Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed after being struck by a ship, and all of the media attention, all of the public attention went immediately to that for a straight week. Now it's started to ebb a little bit in the news cycle, and we're getting some more, you know, politics and other things in there. Of course, you know, in Baltimore, there's also a competitive mayoral race and city council president. There's a lot competing for people's time, and that story did kind of die down. That said, when we called people who took our poll, a couple people did offer that gave them pause about David Trone. And, you know, I was just chatting with a Democratic voter the other day who said that should be disqualifying. You know, they'll never vote for him based on that comment. So it'll be interesting to see if people remember that by the time they go to early voting or election day voting in May, or if they're thinking about it, if they're doing their mail-in ballot now. And, you know, look, there's time for Alsobrooks to use that to her advantage, potentially. I don't know if they're going to or not. That'll be interesting to see for sure.
Yeah, and Jacob, this is a great segue into something you had in your story that you wrote for our subscribers at Inside Elections about. It appears to be a strategic choice that the Alsobrooks campaign is making to not go negative on Trone. Now, traditionally, as someone who's been watching campaigns for a little while, usually when someone's in a competitive race, if you're not going negative, then usually it doesn't end well for that candidate. Talk a little bit about that, and Pamela, interested in your perspective on that back and forth.
Yeah, this is something that's just been so striking to me that this campaign, at least in a paid media environment, has been entirely positive for both candidates. They throw some elbows on the stump and in forums, but when it comes to TV ads and paid communications, neither of them have gone after each other. And that's especially striking to me with Alsobrooks, because she is trailing and because there are such good hits against Trone. It's not just the racial slur. It's the money that he donated to Republicans like Greg Abbott and Doug Ducey. Over the years, he's obviously donated a lot more to Democrats, but he did sign checks to Republicans. That was a big deal in his 2016 House race that he lost the Democratic primary to Jamie Raskin. It's all out there, and it's clearly salient for Democratic voters, especially at a time when you've got Doug Ducey, who, you know, appointed the justices on the Arizona Supreme Court that just reinstated that 1864 law. And you've got Greg Abbott in Texas doing all sorts of things that get Democrats mad. And yet they're not doing anything with it yet. And I think what I heard was basically that this is about scarcity of resources, and that Alsobrooks does not have enough money to do both yet, and that the most important thing is to be introducing herself to voters, especially in the Baltimore media market, getting out that positive message. And it's only after she burns in the positive, if she's still got money, that she can kind of go on the negative. But you know, it seems like they're leaving money on the table, as it were, leaving hits on the table, and there aren't any outside groups like Emily's List or you know, other friendly powers out there that have the money and the motivation, it seems like, to go in and do the dirty work for also Brooks. And I just wonder if we end up with a Trone victory, whether that strategic decision will be revisited following the primary.
Yeah, I think this has something to do with sort of the way Maryland is. Politicians here like to talk about how it's a middle temperament state. And honestly, one of my sources is a Democratic strategist who's worked in multiple states and expresses frustration and how people here are too nice and people don't go, like, we don't get a lot of, you know, bare knuckle politics. Like 2 years ago, I covered a gubernatorial primary where there were 10 people on the ballot in the Democratic primary, and probably like four or five of them had like legit backgrounds and reasons to run. We had two cabinet secretaries. This is the one that was ultimately won by Wes Moore, who is the governor. And on the surface, they, you know, all of the ads were positive. Nobody had a negative hit ad. There in the forums and debates, it was sort of kind of mild, you know, criticism. Now, sure, behind the scenes, were they all trying to plant stories, you know, against each other, their teams? Like, yes, but outside to what the voters saw, it was like pretty calm and polite. And we're sort of seeing that with Trone and also Brooks. And I think you hit on a good point. She only has so much money, and her team believes that when they introduce her to people and that they tell people, or she appears in an event, that she wins people over. And they're kind of going on that strength because, you know, that's what they're focusing their money on. Do they have enough money to go negative or respond to a negative if Trone goes hard against her?
Yeah. Well, it would be interesting to see when a candidate finally breaks that campaign culture in Maryland to see if it works, right? I mean, I think a lot of people say they don't like negative ads, or they don't want candidates to go negative, but then when they hear the negatives, they're like, oh man, I didn't know that. Like, and it legitimately impacts their vote. But, you know, you've described a situation where it's easier to see the reluctance to penetrate that norm, you know, that normal way of doing things. You don't want to be the first one risking a backlash if you do, but it also could be effective. And also Brooks appears to be in a situation where she's got to change the dynamic of the race because she's going to get outspent, you know, continually by millions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, negative campaigning, it works. Like, people, voters say they don't want it, but, you know, reliably it works.
And sure. I wasn't covering politics at this time, but it's my recollection that the 2016 primary between Van Hollen and Donna Edwards got kind of chippy. Now, maybe that was just kind of in the news media environment and not so much in paid media, but I always kind of, you know, living in Maryland at that time, it felt like, wow, this is a really contentious, like, these are two people who don't like each other and are really going at it.
That's probably the last one, the most recent one, where we've had, you know, very competitive and, like you said, chippy. So that's going back, 8 years now?
Yeah. And you got to go even further back to find not just a primary that was so competitive, but a general election in the Senate in Maryland that really had the chance to go either way. So that's where we're going to go next, to the general election that is awaiting the winner of this Democratic primary between Trone and also Brooks, which will be the first competitive general election in Maryland in 18 years. Let's take a brief listen to the man who is responsible for all that.
And that is why I have made the decision to run for the United States Senate. Not to serve one party, but to try to be part of the solution to fix our nation's broken politics and fight for Maryland. That's exactly what I did as your governor, and it's exactly how I'll serve you in the United States Senate.
That, of course, was former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, the two-term Republican who really shocked the state's political class when he made a last-minute entrance, and I truly mean last minute, just a couple hours before the filing deadline, into this Senate race. Maryland hasn't had a competitive general election Senate race in 18 years. In 2006, Ben Cardin defeated Michael Steele by about 10 points. But it looks like we're back to that older era. Pamela, why is Hogan such a compelling candidate for Republicans in Maryland, a state that has not gone Republican for Senate in 40 years, coming up on 50 years, I think?
Yeah, it's been a long time. And look, I'll be honest, I thought I was going to be done with this election on May 15th. that was it, right? Alsobrooks Strone duking it out in the primary, and then whichever one would just sort of like waltz to the general election. The Republican Party in Maryland is really struggling. Very challenging for them to field competitive candidates. But the exception to that is Larry Hogan. So he is the two-term former Republican governor. He had astonishingly high popularity approval ratings throughout his tenure, you know, often in the 60s, occasionally touching 70. And he was elected, reelected very easily. He really appealed to, he got some crossover Democrats and enough independents. You know, he was like, I'm not going to raise your taxes. We're going to help business in the state, kind of your Chamber of Commerce Republican. And, you know, people like that. Nobody wants our taxes raised. And, you know, he did better than a lot of other Republican governors in COVID. You know, came through that well. He had, you know, more restrictions and things, which, you know, he angered more Republicans than Democrats during that time. So yeah, he jumped in at the last minute, and suddenly the Democratic Party, whoever their nominee is going to go against a formidable candidate who is already popular, already well-known, and is getting national money to back his race here in Maryland for Senate.
Yeah, I think I saw this morning that the NRSC was already doing a coordinated ad with Hogan. They're clearly highly invested in him. And look, the numbers show that, right, if the election were held today, I think Hogan would be the clear favorite. It, like you said, it's been a little bit of a polapalooza, but just looking at the most recent surveys, he's either up by four, which is good, better than being down by four, or he's up by 20, or, you know, I think that Fox 45 poll had some pretty serious leads for him. The banner poll was a little bit narrower, and then the post poll was also kind of right there in the middle. But it puts this race on the map, right, in a way that Democrats can't ignore. And, you know, I think you mentioned a little bit, it has kind of changed the tenor of the Democratic primary in terms of surfacing this question of electability to the front of voters' minds, and both Trone and Alsobrooks having to shift their messaging to address that concern. But I guess I part of me just kind of wonders how real do you think Hogan will be when all is said and done? I mean, Maryland is such a Democratic state. It voted for Biden by upwards of 30 points. It hasn't voted, you know, Mac Mathias, I think last won in 1976 as a Republic. I mean, is it possible? you know, and kind of who, if, do you have a sense of who the Democrats are who would vote for Larry Hogan? Who are the Larry Hogan Democrats that are going to be so central to this race come the fall?
Yeah, so I think Larry Hogan is a very real candidate, and he has a very real shot. Now, Maryland does lean Democratic. All of the, you know, the ratings still have it lean instead of like lock solid, it's leans Democratic. And one thing to think about the electorate is that it's actually about 2-1-1, right? About, you know, not quite half. Or about half Democratic voters, and then Republican voters, and then independent, unaffiliated, and third party voters. And, you know, people often say it's 2-1 Democrats or Republican, but they forget there's a significant portion of independent voters out there. And Hogan has appealed again to those independents and persuadable Democrats with his I'm going to be bipartisan, which is an interesting claim from him. I'm against taxes. What Democrats are going to have to do, whoever the nominee is, and what they are probably going to do is make this a one-issue general election campaign about abortion and reproductive rights, because a Democrat voting for Hogan for governor is one thing. Voting for him to be in the Senate is another thing. And Democrats are going to harp on Larry Hogan's sort of unclear record on abortion and reproductive care. They're going to talk about how this could flip control of the Senate to Republicans. And they're going to hammer on that message to say, hey, maybe he was okay as governor, but you as a Democrat, as a liberal voter, you don't want him in the Senate. He will do, you know, more harm than good. That's, I think, what we're going to see in the general election.
Yeah. And he just, there was a story today by the Associated Press where I think they were asking him, making sure he would continue to caucus with Republicans if he were elected. And he said, yes, you know, that he's a Republican. And to me, you've boiled it down very well about that. There are voters who liked Governor Hogan. They might still like him even through this race, but they also don't want Republicans to be in control of the United States Senate, right? And so his favorability rating may not move all that much, but that doesn't mean that they want all these other Republicans in charge, even if they like the Republican that they've had as governor. And the other thing that stuck out to me about the polls is I'm interested to see, let's get, you know, a month plus out from this primary, because I'm going to make an educated guess that there are some Democratic voters who, let's say for also Brooks, who when asked in a general election, would you vote for David Trone? They're like, no, or they're having a hard time and saying, no, I'm an also Brooks, you know, or a Trone supporter who say, would you vote for also Brooks in the general election? And say, yeah, no, you know, that they're more on the fence because they're in the middle of this fight. But when we get beyond the primary, the dynamic is going to change. And I think we'll start to see that Democratic nominee, you know, make some progress in whatever lead Hogan has right now.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, remember, Larry Hogan has had like zero negative coverage of him since he launched. You know, the Democrats have been focused on each other, understandably. They have not been messaging strongly against Hogan. I mean, down here in Annapolis yesterday, there were some progressive groups and unions talking about why he would be a bad choice for Maryland, you know, but that was just a small press conference with a couple people. It's going to ramp up after the primary. And I think Democrats are going to educate voters on, look, a governor has a certain issues and a senator has other issues, and those issues are important to you. I think it will shift once voters say, well, whoever it is, it's the Democrat versus Larry Hogan. And, you know, defeating Larry Hogan being more important than getting the Democratic candidate you prefer, I think voters will get there. And look, I spoke yesterday with one state lawmaker here who is, you know, full in for Trone, you know, cut commercials for him. And she said, look, whoever wins the next day, I'm knocking on doors because I hate Larry Hogan so much. And I think you'll probably see that Democratic unity.
Well, one thing is for sure, we will be talking about this race all the way to November, which as a Marylander warms my heart. All right, let's keep it moving. There are, in addition to the Senate race, a couple of interesting House races going on in Maryland as well. We're going to focus on just one here right now, and that is in your home district of Maryland's 3rd, where Congressman John Sarbanes is not seeking re-election. Let's take a listen to a couple of the campaign ads that have been on the airwaves in this district over the last couple weeks.
You think after January 6th, we see change, but greedy corporations and corrupt politicians went right back to rigging the system. I'm Harry Dunn, and I'll protect democracy from more than just Donald Trump.
I'm Sarah Elfrith, a Democrat running for Congress who knows how to get things done. From expanding abortion access to banning guns in public places, increasing child care funding, and much, much more. In Congress, I'll keep getting results for Maryland.
Those were ads from former Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn and State Senator Sarah Elfrith, two of the many candidates running to succeed Sarbanes in the Democratic primary. There are a lot of people in this race. I mean, a lot of current and former elected officials. But it does feel like Dunn and Alfreth have positioned themselves as the two leading candidates in the race. I think just this morning, the Dunn campaign put out a poll showing him nominally ahead of Alfreth, 22 to 18%, with the rest, no other candidate, I think, touching double digits. This is your home district, Pamela. What has been the story of this race, especially with a guy like Harry Dunn and the national attention and celebrity that he brings to what is typically a pretty quiet congressional district?
Yeah, this is super interesting. And there are 22 Democrats on the ballot. And let me tell you, we've just put out our voter's guide at the Baltimore Banner where we do questionnaires, and wrangling 22 people to try and answer emails is a challenge. Is certainly, you know, Harry Dunn getting in the race kind of upended things, because you have a bunch of people who are running who are, you know, state lawmakers, local business owners, lawyers, that sort of thing. And then suddenly you have this celebrity, you know, hero cop with national connections. I mean, his fundraising reports just came out, and he raised, you know, millions of dollars, you know, way more than anybody else. He has money from across the country, interestingly. Something like 90% of his money comes from outside of Maryland. And to be clear, he does not live in the district. Now, of course, you do not have to live in the district. He lives in Silver Spring, just outside D.C., and this district is basically a Baltimore suburban district in Howard and Anne Arundel. But yes, Harry Dunn, State Senator Sarah Alfreth, kind of ahead of the pack. I would add in also State Senator Clarence Lamb, who's from Howard County. He's sitting on about $500,000 in these final weeks, so he's got some money to be competitive and get his message out there. Everybody else really kind of struggling to gain a foothold with money or with polling. But I really think it's a low information and a low interest race. I don't know that voters are very aware of who the candidates are, or even that there is, you know, a congressional race.
Yeah, and this race also got a bit of a shakeup when United Democracy Project, which is the super PAC affiliate of APAC, got involved here on behalf of Alfreth tune of, I haven't checked the recent numbers, but it was an initial buy of like $600,000. Maybe it's up over $1 million now, you know, running pro Alfreth ads, giving her some additional firepower. That I know, you know, Dunn and his campaign were very upset about that. I think there was a lot of immediate reaction from Dunn on APAC getting involved here. And it was a little bit confusing as to why they were, because neither Dunn nor Alfreth are particularly, no one looks at them and says, you know, their positions on Israel are one thing or the other. And I think they both have good relationships with APAC. And as it turns out, I think it was because of ostensibly because of another candidate in the race, John Morse, a labor lawyer who has taken some positions on Israel that were more frightening to the folks at APAC. And so they felt by going in for Alfreth, they were going to box him out, even though, as all the polling shows, he's not really a factor. So an interesting development there.
Yeah, money coming in and those ads for Alfreth, they are sort of boosting her signal. And what's interesting is, like, we had Harry Dunn and some of the other candidates out here in Annapolis a few weeks ago, standing in the rain, decrying this involvement in the race. But even beside that, like, on the surface, all the advertising, all the flyers, like, they're not really talking about, you know, Israel and the Gaza war. It's, again, we're seeing mostly the biographical kind of, you know, above board kind of stuff going on in the race. So, but it is boosting her. Still, she has nowhere near as much money and firepower, even with that APAC affiliated money coming in.
And this race is a good example of why it's important to turn out in primaries, because this primary is effectively electing a member of Congress. I mean, there will still be a general election, but it's more of a formality. And so I think I should have looked at the list before we started recording this podcast about, I mean, there's already probably up to 10, including close to 10 members or 10 candidates who have won competitive primaries in solid districts. I'm looking at a bunch of races in California and elsewhere where the next Congress is taking shape. And so it's important to vote in general elections as well as primaries, because sometimes that's the biggest game.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case in the 3rd District. There's, I believe, 9 Republicans running in the primary, none of them with any name recognition, money, wherewithal. They're really just not going to have much of a chance. So, you know, May 14th, Election Day, Harry Dunn, Sarah Alfreth, Clarence Lam, somebody else, like that's almost guaranteed to be the winner in the general. And yeah, that's your member of Congress.
And no runoff, right? I mean, a plurality in this with that many candidates, it could be a pretty low a low winning percentage to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is like even the folks who don't have money, some of them include state delegates, Delegate Mike Rogers from Anne Arundel, Delegate Terry Hill from Howard County. I mentioned Clarence Lam, state senator from Howard County. People are used to seeing their names on the ballots and voting for them. They might have seen them in the local news for, you know, what they do here in Annapolis. So they could just, based on familiarity, like siphon off some votes away from those higher contenders. And yeah, you could win this with, I don't know, 15 or 20, 20% could win. It's kind of wild.
We don't have time to talk about them today, but we also have open primaries in the 2nd District, where Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger is headed to the exits, and the 6th District, where David Trone is vacating, obviously. More competitive race in the 6th District. We'll have to have you come back sometime in the future and talk about those other ones. But we are going to keep things moving here and head over to our final segment of the day. And finally, our last segment, Look What I Found, where we highlight something new that we've come across in our daily lives. It could be political, music, sports, or something else entirely. You never know what you're going to get. So Nathan, why don't you kick us off today? What did you find?
Yeah, well, I found a band called Action Adventure, which I've talked about previously on this podcast. They're from Chicago. I think they're called Easy Core, which is a mix of probably pop punk with some hardcore in it. Anyway, they're playing in DC in May, and I bought tickets. I'm going to try to go. I haven't been to a show in a long time, but I'm not supposed to be speaking to any group about the elections, but I'm excited. We'll see. I'm excited. I used to go to more shows a lot more frequently, but we'll see. And if there's any listeners to the podcast that find me at the show, I'm going to say it. I'll give you a 6-month subscription inside elections if you find me at the Action Adventure show in DC.
Well, if someone takes you up on that, you gotta shout them out on the podcast, because I would be very impressed.
I'm guessing it's a very small crossover segment of people.
Sliver of the Venn diagram.
I don't know. In DC, I feel like anything is possible, right? Like, people pay attention.
Let's go for it.
That's true. Yeah. Pamela, what did you find this week?
So I have not found much new lately because I'm just coming off of Maryland's legislative session, which is 90 days of like working 10-hour days every day. But I might be the last person on the planet to pick up The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride. It's a really great book. I'm really enjoying it very much. And it's nice to be able to read something for pleasure that is not like a fiscal analysis of a policy bill.
slightly different genres, I guess, of reading.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I've heard good things about it. It's on my list. So we'll have to get to it, but good to know it's as good as people say. What did I find? I found ramps. And not the thing for getting up to a higher surface, but the wild root vegetable allium that only grows for about 3 weeks of the year out in Western Maryland and West Virginia and places like that. We are kind of at the tail end of ramp season, but I have been taking full advantage of the ramps that have become available, doing all sorts of things with them. Pesto and if I had a grill, I'd be grilling them all the time. But I really like them. They're like a cool, fun thing you only get for a couple weeks of the year. So we'll see if the DuPont Circle Farmers Market still has them this weekend. But they have for the last couple weeks, and so they might be running out. But that is my latest in culinary adventures with Jacob.
Does this go with your rabbit that you're going to be
wild
making?
Wild rant. I bet you could do, Pamela, my grocery store started stocking rabbit recently.
Oh, my.
And I impulse bought rabbit from the butcher shop. I haven't made it yet, but Nathan thinks that's pretty funny. But yeah, I'm sure Ramps and rabbit would go wonderfully together. I'll have to have you over for dinner, Nathan, and
I can... I might need to eat before, and not that I don't trust you. this is stretching my guardrails of what I consider to be proper eating. So we'll see.
All right. Well, on that note, that is all the time we have. We talked through the Maryland Senate Democratic primary, the general election, some of those House races in Maryland that are coming up in just a few short weeks. Pamela, thank you so much for joining us today. This really was a pleasure, and we hope to have you on back again as these Maryland races continue to be at the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun.
At Inside Elections, we provide nonpartisan analysis of congressional, presidential, and gubernatorial races. With a combination of reporting and data, we break down the key races and bring valuable context to complex elections. Go to insideelections.com to subscribe to the biweekly newsletter. We've got individual subscriptions and group packages that are tailored for association and corporate PACs. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and rate us on your favorite platform. If you're watching on YouTube, hit the thumbs up button, leave a comment, and be sure to subscribe. If you don't like today's episode, please email Anthony Daniels, the C-3PO actor, not the failed congressional candidate. We also wanted to thank our producers, Alan Tuzinski and Melissa Lenner of Pretty Easy Podcasts, and associate producer, Conrad Tolosa. Please come back and join us next time.